Today I'm going to talk about nirvana. So, Nirvana Day, there's a day called Nirvana Day, in case you didn't know. And it's a day that's set aside in the Buddhist calendar to mark the passing of Shakyamuni Buddha and to honor his teachings, to extend gratitude to Shakyamuni for his teachings. And next week we're actually going to have a ceremony after the Saturday morning talk. We'll have a Nirvana Day ceremony, but I do want to kind of brief you about it today. So as you know, Shakyamuni Buddha lived to be 80 years old, which is pretty old 2,500 years ago. Can you imagine what the average lifespan in India was 2,500 years ago? So he lived to be 80 years old, a way I think of it as well past retirement age. So, and he grew old and weak. At the end of the Nirvana Sutra, the Buddha says, speaking to his disciples, he says, good men, I'll say good people, cultivate your minds, be conscientious, and avoid indolence. Now my back hurts, my whole body aches, I want to lie down like a small infant or someone who is chronically ill. Having said that, he entrusted the Dharma to his disciples. And the sutra says he lay down on his right side like someone who was ill. So listen to these words. Good people, cultivate your minds. This is at the very end of his life. You can imagine, you know, everybody's been pestering him for, you know, tell us what to do. Don't die. Tell us what to do. Tell us what to do. And he keeps saying, the Dharma, if you see the Dharma, you see me. Study the Dharma. Study the Dharma. Return to the Dharma. So he's talking, and he says, good people, cultivate your minds, be conscientious, and avoid indolence. Now my back hurts, my whole body aches, and I want to lie down like a small infant or someone who is chronically ill. And then he lay down on his right side like someone who was ill. Now you notice it says like someone who is ill, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So very soon after that, he died of food poisoning. Sometimes they say it's mushrooms, sometimes they say it's pork. But the point is, his death was quite an ordinary one. Someone was telling me recently that they... You know how people like to go back and come up with psychological diagnoses or physical diagnoses about things that have happened in the past? And somebody went back and decided that he had some kind of intestinal problems related to old age, and that it wasn't necessarily the food that killed him. But anyway, traditionally he died of food poisoning. So what does this tell us? It's a reminder that impermanence is a fact in our world. Everything changes. Nothing is fixed. Even Shakyamuni Buddha grew old, grew sick, and died. In some Buddhist traditions, including our own, there's a larger sense of what Buddha means. Right? And we're going to talk about that too. But there's no getting around it. In the early Buddhist tradition, very clear. Buddha grew old, sick, and died of food poisoning. His back ached. He wanted to curl up. He felt miserable. Right? It's in the sutras, in the early canon and in the Nirvana Sutra. This story, I think, touches us, doesn't it? Touches us in a way. each time I hear it, I appreciate it in a new way. And this time, I thought, what carried the Buddha? What supported the Buddha for so long? He taught for 40 years. Well, you know, till the moment before he died, he was teaching. And I think what carried the Buddha was great compassion born from awakening. So seeing through his own delusion and suffering, he saw the delusion and suffering of all beings, and he was moved to respond. At first, they say, when he first was enlightened, he kind of didn't, he just was like, this is cool, I'm staying here, right? And the gods came to him and said, please, there are those with just a little dust in their eyes. Please teach. And so he did. So he walked everywhere, walked on foot all over India, preaching the Dharma. This is great compassion, isn't it? And this great compassion is the heart of the Buddha. And this great compassion grows when we allow ourselves to be touched by impermanence ourselves. When we allow ourselves to be touched and moved by impermanence, we see ourselves more clearly and we see others more clearly. When we see ourselves, when wisdom, I, functions, we see ourselves more clearly and others more clearly. We tend to be a little kinder, a little more patient, a little more effective. We know we're all in the same boat, right? We're all have good days, have bad days. We're all finding our way in the world of change. We all experience loss. One time, I don't remember where it was, I saw a painting of the arhats, the disciples, the awakened ones, after the Buddha's death. And it was amazing, you know, the anguish on the face of the disciples. I mean, think about it. The Buddha just died. You know, the guide, the light, the one who basically told you how to live your life, is absolute grief, bereftness. So I'll never forget that picture. It's in my mind. But I think we all know this experience. This is part of the world of impermanence. We all know the experience sometimes, I think, of being lost, of losing a loved one, losing our way, losing our sense of practice, losing heart. And then we can hear the Buddha's voice across the millennia, across time and space, saying, turn to the Dharma. When you see the Dharma, you see me. When we hear that, we are recalled to our path, and we have, you know, encouraged. Courage means heart, right? Not emotional heart, as like bravery or gutsiness, and you know, our heart becomes bigger. We find gratitude. We come alive in a new way. This is refuge, right? This is what refuge means. Refuge means to fly back. So this passing of the Buddha teaches us something about our world and about what actually supports us to wake up. This is the central question, right? What does it mean to live a life of awakening? Buddha was the awakened one. That's what it means. He is said to have attained nirvana, complete awakening, complete liberation. His death is referred to as parinirvana. And technically what that term means is for a person who has attained nirvana in their life, when they die, they enter parinirvana, like complete liberation. Suzuki Roshi said that nirvana appeared when Buddha gave up everything. So he didn't get something. He didn't attain is kind of an odd word. He didn't attain something in a way. He didn't get something. He gave up everything. And so this tells us that this awakening is not something we can grasp any more than we can grasp our life. It's something that arises. So nirvana is liberation. And its meaning is extinguishing blindness and delusion. Completely extinguishing blindness and delusion. Everything that binds us and leads us to suffer. The image that's often used is a flame blown out. Burning passions and delusions are extinguished. I always had kind of a little trouble with that. I always felt like extinguished seems so flat in a way. If we think of it in terms of burning passions being blown out, then that is helpful, right? But I learned not too long ago that in India, at the time of the Buddha, flames were considered to be a part of the atmosphere that burned fitfully until they're released back into the cool spaciousness of air. So if you look at it from that point of view, to extinguish a flame is to allow it to return to its true nature, to be freed from the bondage that makes it jump and flit around, right? So I think that's the thing we want to remember about nirvana, is it's not extinguishing life or it's extinguishing that which binds us and causes us to be restless and suffer and fitful. And it's also true that if the flame is a part of the atmosphere, even when it's burning fitfully, it's still a part of the atmosphere. It's not something separate from the atmosphere. It's just in a certain form right now. It's in a certain form of that is cranky and uncomfortable and restless. But it's not something else. It just hasn't remembered yet. So the Nirvana Sutra has a bunch of metaphors about liberation. And I thought I'd share some of them with you. And each of these ends with the same sentence. There is nothing oppressive in liberation, such as traveling on foot on a hot day or touching something cold in winter. In true liberation, there is nothing that approximates these things. Nothing oppressive is a metaphor for true liberation, and true liberation is precisely what the Tathagata is. To not be oppressive, moreover, can be compared to the sun and the moon that do not oppress living beings. In like manner, liberation contains nothing that could oppress living beings. To say there is nothing oppressive is thus a figurative way to express true liberation. And true liberation is precisely what the Tathagata is. Non-substantiality, moreover, pervades the Dharma Dhatu. The Dharma Dhatu is the realm of the Dharma. The nature of the Dharma Dhatu, this is the realm of the Dharma in the sense of the realm of liberation, is true liberation itself. And true liberation is what the Tathagata is. When an Enchantaka, moreover, exhausts what makes him an Enchantaka, he can no longer be labeled an Enchantaka, okay? So, what in fact is meant by the name Enchantaka? Enchantakas are those who have destroyed all wholesome karmic roots within themselves. Their mindset is one that does not aspire to any wholesome dharmas. And they may even reach the point where not one wholesome thought occurs to them. Have you ever felt that way? We can be Enchantakas, right? In true liberation, there is no one like this. In fact, it is precisely because of the absence of anything like this that it is true liberation. And true liberation is what Tathagata is. In addition, I refer to liberation as immense, as an ocean has no equal in size. Liberation similarly cannot be equated with anything. The absence of any equivalent is precisely what true liberation is. And true liberation is what the Tathagata is. In addition, liberation is the destruction and abandonment of all forms of greed. Liberation such as this is what the Tathagata is, and the Tathagata is none other than the Dharma itself. Liberation is deliverance. In that it can rescue one from all sources of fear. Liberation such as this is what the Tathagata is, and the Tathagata is himself, the Dharma. Liberation is itself refuge. The lack of upheavals is what true liberation is. True liberation is what the Tathagata is, and the Tathagata is what Dharma is. In addition, liberation eliminates the darkness of ignorance. It is like when you take the best quality butter and remove its impurities, yielding what is called clarified butter. Liberation is like this. Removing the dregs of ignorance produces true light. This true light is what true liberation is. And true liberation is what the Tathagata is. In addition, I call liberation the water element. The analogy of the water element comes from the fact that among the four elements, water is the most prominent, thoroughly pervading all grasses, trees, and seeds. Liberation is like this, for it pervades all forms of life. It is the Tathagata that is liberation, such as this. In addition, I refer to liberation as steadfast, analogous to the threshold of a door, for wind cannot move it. True liberation is also like this, and it is liberation such as this that is what the Tathagata is. You notice, every single time they say, is what the liberation is what the Tathagata is. The Tathagata is the thus kanwa. The Tathagata is Buddha. So again and again and again, they describe these different aspects or metaphors for liberation. But every single, this is what sutras do, right? They're like refrain after refrain after refrain, telling us again and again and again, this is what liberation is. It is the Tathagata that is liberation. This is liberation, such as this, is precisely what the Tathagata is. So the Tathagata and liberation are identical. The Buddha, 2,500 years ago, now more than that, got sick, ate pork, was weak, body ached, and died. And at the same time, the Tathagata, the spirit of liberation, is not absent from this world. When we turn to the Dharma, we see the Buddha. The sutra tells us again and again that the Tathagata is awakening. That means nirvana cannot be squeezed into the categories we have for it. It's not bound by time or space. And the metaphors, these metaphors, and there are many more, point us to something beyond our usual thinking. When we honor the passing of Shakyamuni Buddha, we're honoring a life of impermanence, the one we've got. But we're also honoring that which isn't captured or bound or fitfully burning. So entering the world of impermanence, fully entering the world of impermanence, we know ourselves, we know other beings, we find liberation, we find great compassion. We are enfolded and supported by great compassion. We are energized by great compassion and by awakening. So that's Buddha's life. That's when Buddha's life comes alive, right? In that moment. Dogen Zenji says, our lives arise and perish within each moment. Their swiftness is like this. Moment after moment, we should not forget this. While being within this swiftness of arising and perishing in each moment, if we arouse one single thought of fearing others before ourselves, the eternal longevity of the Tathagata immediately manifests itself. Let me read that to you again. Our lives arise and perish within each moment. Their swiftness is like this. Moment after moment, we should not forget this. While being within this swiftness of arising and perishing in each moment, if we arouse one single thought of fearing others before ourselves, the eternal longevity of the Tathagata immediately manifests itself. So staying close to impermanence, staying close to arising and passing away, we stay close to the shared life of all being, which, when we realize it, is liberating. We see differently when we do this. When we notice the swiftness of our lives arising and perishing in each moment, when we don't forget, as Dogen Zenji tells us, moment after moment, we should not forget this. While being within this, while being within this very life of arising and passing away, of losing loved ones, of struggling, of falling down, of getting up, of seeing change all the time, while being within this swiftness of arising and perishing in each moment, we're in it, that's what we are, that's where we live. If we arouse one single thought of fearing others before ourselves. In other words, if we pay attention to this dynamic vitality of this shared existence, that we are this shared existence, we can't help but be touched by impermanence, by seeing that we're in the same boat, by seeing that other beings are also falling down and getting up. And we are, our being opens to them. It opens. We remember who we are. Then the thought of fearing others before ourselves arises. The thought of awakening for the benefit of all beings, right, arises. When that arises, the eternal longevity of the Tathagata immediately manifests itself. Well, how, you might ask? That's a good question. You could spend a long time with that question. How? Talked about how before, right? How is our family name, we say. How? But we can believe what Dogen Zenji says, that when we enter this impermanent life, when we're willing, when we pay attention to the swiftness and the thought of this immediate interdependent life arises, the Tathagata is present in that moment. So when we do that, we see reality beyond and participate in reality beyond our narrow, self-centered expectations, ideas, categories. And we taste, as we say, taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. So, very simple, very profound. Try it. Pay attention to impermanence. What is that like for you? You, individually. What is it like for you to notice impermanence? How much does it take for you to pay attention to impermanence? You know? Sometimes we can be extremely resistant and then has to be something dramatic that happens before we notice that we haven't been paying attention. But if we actually orient ourselves in this way and understand that, as Dogen says, when we pay attention to the swiftness of passing, when we are awake to this life of impermanence, then liberation becomes, it's like this. The Tathagata's presence is like this. So I really encourage you to pay attention to impermanence, and in doing, honor Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching and his liberation and his aching body, and we do this together.